Thank you, Milton. Well, yeah, tell them about that used car sale. Boy, I'm not going to say anything about that. My name's Ray, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be here and sober. What a wonderful weekend. I don't know when I've enjoyed myself more. Y'all ought to give yourself a round of applause. I really enjoyed it. Anybody that had anything to do with this thing, or, I've never had so much fun in my life and been so peaceful and serene. I felt like I was serene. I don't know. I've been scared all day. But walking around here looked like we'd eat and go to a meeting, go back and eat, and go to the room and eat, and lay down and come back and eat and go to a meeting. Hell, that's a boy. When are we going to stop? I'm glad this thing don't last 2 weeks. Colleen was saying last night she was a little nervous. I'm a lot nervous. I get nervous, especially when I follow these heavy hitters. Boy, she did great, and Bob did great today. And I've been sitting around talking to Wally, and I know what it'll be like in the morning. And we have a old commercial in Memphis of a Jewish lawyer, and he's talking about, if you want to sue anybody, get me to do it for you, because I'm a heavy hitter. And I think about these heavy hitters that's been up here speaking, and I feel like sometimes maybe I feel like I'm going to be a little intimidated, but I'm going to try to do the best I can. I made so many new friends, Colleen and Wally. And of course, Bob and I go back a long ways, and of course, I love him and do anything in the world for him. Well, except one thing. I won't ride in that damn airplane with him. He's a pilot, and my kids and grandkids, I always want to fly with Paul. I said, come on, Daddy. I said, no, I ain't going to ride now. Paul's a good pilot. I said, yeah, but he's going to have a heart attack someday, and I don't want to be with him. I said, no, no. So I let them do. Getting that back, being a little scared and nervous, and show you how nervous I get. I went up to Somerville to talk a couple of years ago, and I went by and picked up a guy I sponsored, and he's my sponsor too, by the way, Ray. And I was a Sunday morning speaker, and it's about 60 miles, and we drove up there, and I thought, boy, I was dressed and feeling good and looking sharp. And a guy walked up to me, and he says, you look pretty nice, but said, you got on a brown shoe and a black shoe. And some people in here was there, so, and about that time, Ray said, yeah, but he got another pair just like it at home. Don't worry. So, and I went around there, and I couldn't find nobody that had a pair of shoes about my size. Well, who in the hell's going to swap a pair of decent shoes for a brown shoe and a black shoe? But we made it, and we made the talk, and made it through it okay, and it's a lot of fun, like we used to have. Tell you something about being a used car salesman. Always don't never ask a used car salesman to talk the same day he's working, because he allowed, give him a few days off like give me this week, because if you get a used car salesman to come from the job to try to carry the message, he'll have to tell you anything the first day. But you give us about 3 or 4 days to think things over, and might get a little honesty in us by then. I certainly didn't start out in life to become an alcoholic. I grew up in a home that... I borrowed this watch from Eddie, so ain't no telling what time it is. So y'all bear with me. If I get too run over too late, just holler and let me know. But I certainly didn't start out becoming an alcoholic. My father was an alcoholic, periodic. And Daddy He could go 3 months maybe, and she couldn't make him take a drink. And if he took one, he might be drunk 3 months. I mean, every day. He might go 6 months without a drink. And then if he ever took one, he might be drunk 6 months. It seemed like the length of time Daddy didn't stay, that he stayed sober and didn't drink, or stayed dry and didn't drink, when he pitched a drunk, it seemed like he thought maybe he deserved that much more time, because he'd stay drunk normally that time and get off of it. But I can remember being frightened. And my daddy was a gentle person and a good man. But I can remember being frightened when he would get on one of these drunks and how he would change. And he didn't get mean, but we had a lot of gypsies that lived around us, and they would trade with my daddy. My daddy had a business, and they would trade with him. And those gypsies would come in there and talk about going out the night before and getting paralyzed drunk. And my daddy would get paralyzed drunk. He could drink a pint of whiskey, and he couldn't walk, and he couldn't talk, and he'd slobber, and it was just embarrassing to us. But that's the way he was, and he would do this months at a time. And it scared me. My mother, my daddy, I said, was a gentle person. He spanked me one time in my life when I was 5 years old, and that was for giving my little sister that was 4 years old a cigarette. That's the only. He didn't say nothing about me smoking that cigarette, but he got mad because I gave my little sister that cigarette. I was 5 years old. That's the only time daddy whipped. Now, my mother was the disciplinarian. She was 4'10". Usually she weighed about 85 pounds. She got up to 100 maybe one time. And could hit harder and faster than anyone I'd ever seen. I believe if Mike Tyson had known that he would have had to fight her, he would have stayed in the penitentiary. I believe that's how tough she was. It was six kids, and we'd all be around. And of course, Daddy didn't do nothing. And my mother was the type that several of you in here that's maybe as old as I am, but she was the type that sent you out to get a switch. And you brought the switch back, and Marge is shaking that head. You brought that switch back, it wasn't big enough. You go back and get another switch. You keep going back till you bring back half a damn tree limb. And she could use it. And we'd be sitting at the dinner table, six of us, kids all fussing and raising sand, and she'd be across that table, slap you before you could knew what was going on. And you knew it was coming, but you couldn't do nothing about it. It was so fast. So that was a disciplinary in the family. I wasn't going to be like Daddy, and I wasn't going to drink. And anybody in my family would have told you that it bothers him so much, he'll never drink. He will not drink. All of them said that. I never have really talked to my brothers and sisters to see it, and I don't think it did affect them to the extent that it did me. I believe alcoholism is hereditary in my family. I have a sister that came in this program 19 years ago, and she doesn't go to AA anymore, but she hadn't returned to drinking. I had a brother that died from liver cancer, extremely heavy drinker that went to a few AA meetings. I have another brother that received a liver transplant down here at Vanderbilt 5 years ago, doing okay today, I guess. I have another brother that drinks every day and has been to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he says AA don't work. And AA don't work. You got to work AA. We all know that. And I've got one sister out of the whole bunch that never drank, but has every defect. If she ever gets started, Katie barred the door. So I believe alcoholism was hereditary, especially in my family. I grew up a small, frightened child, and I, at the age of 15 years old, I did something that I said I was never going to do. I got drunk. And I don't know if it was peer pressure or what it was, but some fellas and myself went over to a place called the Cotton Club in West Memphis, where I live today. Everybody thinks I'm from Memphis, but I really live in Arkansas. But it's the same thing, really, just across the bridge. But we went over to West Memphis to the Cotton Club, and it was we had stopped on the way and bought some beer. And I drank two or three cans of that beer, and I never had drank any before. And I said, this stuff ain't that bad. You know, really, it's not that bad. It don't taste that good, but it's not that bad. But I felt a little glow. So we decided we would go to the Cotton Club, and we stopped, and we got this guy to buy some quarts. We were 15 years old. This Cotton Club, it was notorious. It had a bad name. And kid, they would let anybody in there. I was about as tall as this thing. Marge shaking her head. I was about as tall as this thing. Could you imagine? And we walked up to the door, and this guy was in a cage, setting up in a cage, I guess, to protect him. I don't know what else, because you could hear music going on. And I handed him $2 to get in that Cotton Club. And we had our sacks full of beer, quart beers, and took them in there. And they had a band on each end of the floor playing different songs, both playing different songs. Everybody was dancing, having a good time. And we got in there, and we started drinking that beer. And before long, I was talking to them women. They weren't really young girls. They were older than I was. And I was talking to them and saying some things that, you know, we always dream about saying, and we can't do it. And then, before long, I was dancing. First time I danced in my life. I had a good voice, but I was scared, but I was singing for long. Told Colleen I should have been down there singing with you today. I had a good voice, and I was getting it out. And you know, and I knew that night, and I was had a good time, and I knew that night that I was going to come back over to that Cotton Club. I also knew that night, too, something else, why my daddy had done this all these years. Boy, I know why he'd done that. But see, I wasn't going to be like him. I was going to drink like a gentleman. I blacked out that night. The very first time that I drank, I got drunk, I blacked out. But I wasn't going to be like him. Next day, you know, I was all here, and we knew what happened and everything, or they did, and I thought I had a pretty good time. But also, I know I was an alcoholic, just waiting on that drink, because I could never get enough of it. That time was like practically every time I ever drank. I could never stop. I could never guarantee you that I was going to stop. I never did want to stop until it was all gone. And then I wanted to keep on. And alcoholism is a progressive disease. I know that today. And I found that out from y'all. I went from 15 years old. And I said before, I was not going to be the drinker that my daddy was. And I wasn't. I was worse. He never was as bad as I was. He could have periods of time that he didn't drink. And once I started, especially after I turned 18 years old, I drank practically every day. I made it through school, and I was always, like I said, a frightened child. And I made the football team, weighed 118 pounds. That was a bad mistake. I'll get into that a little later on. But I always wanted to be something that I wasn't. But I was going to that cotton club on the weekend when I get a chance. I made the football team, and I made it through school, and I went to service, and the service was, especially the U.S. Air Force. Wally and I were talking about it earlier. It was a great place for an alcoholic. You know, the beer was 15 cents and a can, and the whiskey was cheap, and money wasn't that good, but it didn't take much money when things was that cheap. And I had a great time. I made it through 4 years of military with one court-martial and drinking every day. I made it through the service. And we were talking earlier, I was really wanting to make a career out of service. I would have really liked to make a career out of service because I liked it. It was easy. I worked in an office, and I worked from 8 to 5, weekends off, drank all you want to. I'd love to be in the service. But back then, they didn't put up with it. They did not put up with that drinking like they do. There wasn't no treatment centers. There wasn't no breaks here and there. They kick you out, and I knew that I couldn't make it because I was depending on it. I was headed every day, and I knew that I was having a problem with it. I came back home, and I married my first wife. We were going together, and she had went to school with me. She was 3 or 4 years younger than I was when I went away to service, and I came back, and she had grown up, and my sister got me a date with her, and we started going out, and I got me a business. My daddy and a man down at the bank helped me get in a truck stop. Bought me a truck stop. Hell, I was going to do with a truck stop, but everybody thought I was going to really set the woods on fire, and I had my everything, I guess, that they thought that I needed. And I guess I thought I was doing pretty good. And I went over to, I was raised, I didn't tell you this, right now, I guess I started off life bad because I was raised right across the state line in Mississippi on a gravel road called the State Line Road, and there was not a name of the town where I wasn't in town. There was no name to this place that I was born. They said, "Where do you live down on the State Line Road?" Well, what? Well, there wasn't no name other than the State Line Road. But anyway, that's where I was raised. Well, I came back home to the State Line Road and out of service, and this girl and all, and we started going together, and I'll get off of this. And I moved over, and I got this business over at Walls, Mississippi. I took the brother that passed away here a few years ago with the liver problems. I took him with me, and we went over and opened this business up. And I started right off the bat drinking. One of us was taking turns of running the business, and the other one was drinking. We'd take time to go up to the beer joint, and I'd come back from the beer joint and give him a rest, and he'd go up there a while. So needless to say, the business wasn't going too well. We were buying gas and filling these big tanks. We was waiting on some of these trucks. We wasn't making much on the gas, but we were selling a lot of gas. But we'd empty the tanks, and then we'd have to call them back to fill them up. And while these tanks were getting filled up, we was getting ours filled up, and wasn't enough money to fill them all up. So we started having problems. The girl that I was going with, her family was a family of non-drinkers. She had one brother that I liked. He would take a drink, but the rest of them, her oldest brother was minister down there at home, and her daddy didn't drink, her mother didn't drink, and she started asking me some questions about my drinking, and she really didn't know to the extent I was drinking, because I'd take her home a lot of times and really throw one on, but she knew that it was a little, wasn't really right. So we started talking about getting married, or she started talking about getting married, and I go along with her, and thought this a thing to do, and it was getting pretty serious, and it was getting a date that was being ready to get set, and I got to thinking about who I could go talk to about my drinking. I knew that this marriage wasn't going to last. This gal didn't like drinking. But she would have tolerated if I was drinking socially. She had said many times she would. But I wasn't drinking socially. We had one man in DeSoto County that was in Alcoholics Anonymous that a few of you in here knew, and that's Franklin Williams. Only person in the whole county. The next county over was Tate County, and we had a fellow named Woodson Hawks, Bob remembers. He was the only one in Tate County. And now this, so some of y'all might think was a long time ago, but it wasn't too long ago to me. It was 1962 and 3. So who could I talk to about my drinking? Who can I talk to about my drinking? I can't walk up to the average guy. You can't do that. Hey, I got a drinking problem. I need to talk to somebody about my drinking. It's always use your willpower. You're much too nice a guy, but I didn't have anybody to talk to. And finally, she said the magic words, "I won't mind you drinking when we get married if you drink at home. I ain't care where I drink. Home suited me fine." We got married, and like so many Al-Anons, 30 days later, she says, "I don't care where you drink if you won't drink in this damn house." That suited me all right, too. I really didn't mind. You know, I was an alcoholic. And I really didn't care where I drank as long as I could drink. My daddy has sent me to jail before, and they let me drink some beer going to jail. And I'd have stayed in jail if I could have drank. I didn't care. It seemed been down there as anywhere. That was my number one priority, because I had got the disease of alcoholism and I couldn't stop. Needless to say, the wife went first and the business went next. And if you are an alcoholic to the extent that I am an alcoholic, and if you drink to the extent that I drink, and you got a wife and you got a family, you got a business, you know, you keep on, sooner or later, they won't be there long. And if you like me, they won't. The only decent thing I guess I did in that marriage, she had went home several times to her parents. And the last time, this was all a year, too. We weren't married but a year. She went home. She was there as much as she was at my house. And finally, she came and she said, "I'll give you one more chance." And I said, "No, I think you better go on and get the divorce." Because I knew I wasn't going to stop drinking. And back then, there wasn't any such thing as it being a disease. You were just plain sorry. And if your mom and daddy hire their lawyer to get your wife a divorce, you damn double sorry. And that's exactly what happened. So I lost her, and I lost the business, and knowing that I had a drinking problem and not knowing what to do. Took a job on the railroad. Boy, that's a good drinking job. The old boy got me the job, says, "Look, if this guy asks you if you drink, tell him yeah, because he ain't going to hire you now if you don't drink." Hell, this was easy. That's the easiest job I ever got. He said, "You take a drink?" I said, "Yeah, I'll take a drink." "Okay." They hired me. That started a string of problems with them. Railroad was a good place to drink, and they really didn't mind you drinking as long as you would come to work. I had problems mixing those two. If I wasn't drinking, I worked every day. But if I was drinking, I didn't work. And they had a problem with me coming to work when I was drinking. Now, I wasn't going to go up there because I'd have got fired. The guy at the union, when I got in the union, he said, "You get drunk and you need to lay off, call up here and tell them you got the flu, man. They can't do anything about it." And I was coming down more and more with the flu. Man, they didn't like it. And I had a bad wreck, and I started again to try to do something about my drinking. I went to a psychiatrist, taking the easy, softer way out. First thing the psychiatrist said was, "You need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous." I said, "Man, I need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous." I said, "Look, and I'm not an alcoholic. I got some problems. I can't sleep. I jerk and I jump. And drinking helps me. If I could stop this jerking and jumping and go get some sleep, I wouldn't have to drink." He said, "All alcoholics have problems. You need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous." This was around 1966, I guess, 67. I didn't tell that guy, but when I started doing all this stuff at the Cotton Club and as a teenager, somebody put a big blue book on my desk, on my dresser in my room. And that old book stayed there a long time. It wasn't quite as thick as the ones we've got today. I guess it was the second edition. And I, every now and then, as a teenager, I would pick it up and I'd open it up and I'd slam it shut. I'd see something there. And on the front of it, it said Alcoholics Anonymous. And the way I got the book was Daddy and a cousin of ours had went to some AA meetings back in the 50s. And some man saw fit to give him a book or set him one, whatever it was, because he was a druggist there in Memphis and he had his name in it, in the front of it, and Daddy ended up with the book. And of course, Daddy went to AA meetings and our cousin, they went together, and they both loved AA. All they did over there at that time was play cards, you know, and hell, Daddy was a good card player, man. He liked that, but AA didn't work for him. So he quit after he won all their money down there or something. I think he left. But anyway, that book was there. But that psychiatrist, getting back to him, he was telling me, he says, "I have very little success with alcoholics." I said, "Why does he keep saying alcoholic, you know? Hell, I knew I couldn't stop drinking, but I didn't know I was an alcoholic." He said, "I don't have much success with alcoholics, and I found out why. One, we don't tell them the truth. And two, we don't pay them." I have very, very little success with alcoholics. I paid him there as long as I was on the railroad. The railroad paid him. I didn't pay him nothing. But anyway, I stayed off of alcohol for the longest time of my life, 5 months. The most miserable 5 months I ever had in my life. I didn't have anywhere to go. I didn't have anything to do. My friends down at the beer joint, I couldn't go see them. They don't want you coming in there and drinking a Coca-Cola. You don't feel right anyway. And I didn't have nothing to do. He gave me some old pills and for my nerves. Worked pretty good. Then he gave me some Anabuse. My daddy had went off to one of these places several times, and Dr. Wright's place down at the road from us at Bahia, and Daddy would go down there, and he'd always give Daddy this Anabuse, and he said, "It'll kill you. It can kill you. If you drink on it, it'll kill you." And I was scared of that Anabuse, and so I brought it home, and I was, for 5 months, I was taking that Anabuse and sleeping good with that medicine he gave me. But it was something about taking this stuff. You know, am I going to have to take this the rest of my life? You know, I got to thinking. I come downstairs in the morning. My mom would have my eggs and my bacon and orange juice, and she'd have this Anabuse tablet sliced in half, sitting right next to my coffee there, my orange juice. And she's watching me. If any of you got anybody in here taking Anabuse, you better watch him. But you better watch him good. Well, Mama was watching me, and I'd taken that thing, and I'd put it on my tongue. And I'd go in there and go to the bathroom, and I'd spit it out. I might not even want a drink, but I detested that thing being inside my body, saying that I can't drink. I detested that. What a freedom that I found in this program, in this fellowship, that I get up every morning and make a choice today whether to drink or stay or not to drink. That's a great choice. I didn't have any choice. I could not drink, and I was mad. I gave him some problems. Well, at the end of this 5 months, I went back to drinking. If I was going to have to do something the rest of my life, I may as well do what I was addicted to, and that's alcohol. Well, alcoholism is a progressive disease. I ended up in the same place Bob had Betty. Gartley Ramsey, Milton was there. I ended up there too, and I loved it over there for a while. Food was great. Hell, they charged big money. I had that insurance. They charged big money. I had steaks every night. And co-educationals. Girls in one room, you might be in the next room. Everybody having a good time. The nurses were telling me, too, you're a nice guy up here. You're much too nice a person to be up here. When you leave here, you go back home and behave yourself. You don't need to be up here. I about lost that job. That's the reason I was up there, because I about lost that job. And I didn't learn nothing up there. They giving you these little puzzles to work, and you put these pegs in these damn holes and this and that, and knit and crochet and things like that. And ain't the first guy said nothing about not drinking. And I was wanting to tell the nurses when they were telling me to go back home, behave myself, and don't come back up there, that please show me how not to drink. I had got down to the point where I knew I had to stop. It was getting to the point where, you know, it was either going to be suicide or a hospital somewhere with a wet brain or in jail somewhere. I'd had numerous wrecks and DWIs that my daddy had got me out of. And broke into a man's business and twice. Wasn't much of a thief. I left something with my name on it both times. But just happened that my daddy knew the people and I got out of it. But I had to do something. But they didn't tell me nothing. And this was in 1968. And I was under investigation at the railroad for not drinking on the job, but for not coming to work. And, I couldn't come to work. I was drunk. And a railroad detective come out to the house and tried to make me come to work. And I was too damn drunk to come to work. And so they fired me for not coming to work. But this was in 1968, and I went back home to my mother and father's, as I was to do many times, and without a job. And this was approximately in September, I think, of 1968, and I made it up till December. Christmas, I didn't drink, taking that antabuse. December the 31st of 1968, New Year's Eve, I started what I hope was my last drunk. I did like my daddy. I made it through Christmas, so I decided I owed myself at least New Year's. I was going to get drunk. I drank until the 12th day of January of 69, and this day was Super Bowl III between the Baltimore Colts and the New York Jets. And I'm a big football fan. I'll tell you about me playing football. I weighed 118 pounds. I was dreaming more. I was watching that game that day, and I had woke up with a bad case of the shakes, and a guy had taken me to get some beer. And I came back home, and I had drank this beer because I really didn't drink from my mother. And I couldn't. She wouldn't let me. But anyway, and I came back home, and I was watching that football game, and old Joe Namath of the Jets had been bragging. Boy, he'd been bragging all week about the Jets were going to beat the Baltimore Colts, and the Jets did not have a chance to beat the Baltimore Colts. They wasn't any good. They didn't have a chance. And lo and behold, I thought I was in the DTs, sitting there, and they'd beaten the stew out of them, and they won the game. Well, Mama came in after that game, and she says, "You know, tomorrow your daddy and I have made arrangements for you to go to Whitfield State Mental Hospital, Mississippi." And I said, "Oh, I can't go to Whitfield. You got to do something about your drinking and nowhere else to go. We've had you in every hospital. We've had you jail. We've had you everywhere else. And you're not going to stop drinking." I didn't want to go to Whitfield because I'd had an old cousin. Well, he was my daddy's cousin, and he was so much older than us, we called him our uncle. But anyway, he's some kind of relation. And as a small child, Willie had been down Whitfield. He's crazy. There was no doubt about it. He's crazy as hell. He'd been down at Whitfield, but they would let him out on a furlough, he called it. And he'd come up to see us about once a year for a couple of weeks. And he wouldn't stay with us, but I mean, he'd come by and see us. He'd stay with his sister. And Willie would tell us as little kids about the people at Whitfield running and butting their heads against the wall and all of them was crazy. Well, he was crazy. We didn't have any doubts about that. But anyway, I was scared to go to Whitfield. So my mother came out with those magic words, Alcoholics Anonymous again. See, she was one that had put that big book on my dresser. And while my daddy went to AA and never did get anything out of it, my mother had went with him to a few speaker meetings, and she had seen what this program had done in y'all's life. She had seen families together and happy and smiling. There wasn't that kind of a, in our family, we didn't have that. And she knew the magic of this program. And that's the reason she kept hounding on AA to me. Every time I'd get in a jam, she'd talk about that AA. I was sick of that AA. But this day, she said, AA, try if you want to. So I got out the yellow pages of the phone book. I didn't know nothing about no AA, but I was going through there. You know, you give a drunk a choice of going to jail or going to a crazy house or anywhere like it, and then tell him something about maybe a place where he won't have all that, and he'll take that place. I might have been insane, but I wasn't crazy. So I started looking for some help. And I come to alcoholism, didn't have but one place, didn't have nothing about no AA in the yellow pages. It says, Alcoholism Rehabilitation Center, Harbor House, 1369 Court Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee. All it said, no more, only one there, no more. I called this guy. He says, name is Harold King. He answered the phone and says, come on up in the morning. Try not to drink. You can talk to the director and see what he says. The sister, somehow or another, I made it through that night, and I got up the next morning and I didn't drink anything. And my sister that didn't drink came and picked me up, and we went up and we found this place, and it was a dilapidated looking building and some old guys sitting out on the porch, rough looking guys, drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. And me and my sister sat out in the car a few minutes, and I said, well, she said, we're going to have to go up there. We didn't know we was at the right place or not, but we thought we were. So we got up there, and the guy said, yeah, it's a harbor house. And they directed me back to the back to see the director. And I walked in, and this guy was sitting there, and his face was red as that shirt that Joe's got on there, and hair growing all out the side of his head. And he stuck his hand out, and he said, I'm Burton Davis, and I'm an alcoholic. I said, hell, I know he's an alcoholic. He didn't have to tell me he is no alcoholic. Boy, I said, what have I got into now? He said, I'm Burton Davis, and I'm an alcoholic. Of course, I didn't know he had been sober maybe 20 years at the time. But he asked me, the first question he asked me, he said, do you believe in God? And I said, yes. And he said, you a damn liar. He says, whatever God you believe in, keep him away from me. My God don't let me get in the shape you're in. Boy, I broke down and started crying. Boy, I was crying. See, I was scared. That guy scared me. Every question that he would ask me, he said, you love your family? Yes, sir. You're a damn liar. Just break down. And this old sister, she was sitting over. Boy, she was eating this. She had hauled me so many places. Poor thing. She had hauled me so many places that she was eating this up. That man was tearing me up. I told you about going playing football when I weighed 118 pounds. And I made that team because I was real fast. I did good, too. I was real fast. But I was real fast because I was real scared. I grew up scared. So everything that he said to me, I break down crying because he didn't give me any breaks. Finally, he said, I ain't got room for you. And boy, I just let out a sigh of relief. And then he said, but I'm going to make room for you. So she left me. And I had given him what money I had. I had a little money saved up because I had a DWI. And, you know, I wasn't going to let that money get away. I was going to pay you that DWI. And I had a little extra money. And I walked to the back door after he let me out of there. And I walked out to get me some air. And I looked across the lot. And there was a wagon wheel, a beer joint that I used to drink in across the alley. You know where the beer, you know where the wagon wheel was? And I said, God, if I can get in that wagon wheel, I'm going to go back in there and get my money. And I stopped. And that man scared. I was scared to get my money from that man. I was scared of him. I was scared of him. So I stayed. Well, you know, things started working out real quick. I went the following night. That night, this was on a Monday, the 13th day of January. And that night, a speaker came to talk to us. And I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know if I was in a place where they were going to teach the program Alcoholics Anonymous or they did 12 steps or anything. I didn't know what I was. I just knew I was there. But this man came, and his name was Doyle Turner, and he made an hour talk. And he said he was an alcoholic, and he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sat there, and I could identify for the very first time in my life, I identified with another alcoholic. The singleness of purpose of our fellowship is so important. I knew from listening to that man talk one time that I was in the right place. He, at the end of that talk, I could swore he was talking about me. But at the end of that talk, I sat around there and I listened, and I didn't say much because I was scared. But something happened. They started letting us out to go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. Wasn't about 8 or 10 groups around Memphis at the time. I guess it's over 100 now. But every night, I would go somewhere. And I'd come back and I felt like I was welcome. I would go somewhere every night and people would just welcome me. And I just said, well, I believe this is where I ought to be. It was a love affair from the very beginning with this fellowship for me. You know, I didn't have any problem whatsoever admitting that I was an alcoholic. After I was there just a day or two, you know, I got to thinking, well, if I ain't an alcoholic, you know, if you get up in the morning drinking and you drink all day long and you can't hold a job and you go to bed at night drunk and you do that 7 days a week, if I ain't an alcoholic, I belong down there where Cousin Willie was. That's for sure. And I didn't have any problem with that. You know, my biggest problem that I knew that I was going to face, and I'd go around these meetings and I would listen to what people would say. My biggest problem was going to be God, you know. We went to church as children. My daddy didn't, but my mother saw that we went. And we went to church as children, and I tried to get form some kind of opinion of God in those days, and I never did. Maybe I just thought I was a little dumb, and I guess probably I was, but I never did. I just knew that there had to be something that had got me out of all those jams that I was in over those years. Something had to get me out of those jams. I found out that I was an agnostic, and I didn't know anything about agnostic. I figured there might be something. But anyway, I went to a meeting one night in Fraser, and I came back, and the next day I was telling Bert, I said, Bert, I know I'm at the right place, and I know going to AA is what I want to do the rest of my life. But I am having a problem with this God bit. I'm having a terrible problem because I'm having a problem forming me a conception. He says, look, says, tell you what you do. He said, this evening, go outside there, and you need to form you some conception of a higher power. That guy don't have to be that old man up there with that thing around his head like you probably think it should be. You could find God within somebody else, within yourself, within out there in one of those trees. But go out there and look at the things that man can't make. And look around at all the things that man can't make. And you form you some conception of a higher power. And you start asking this higher power for help in the morning. And you thank him throughout the day. And you thank him at night when you go to bed. And you do the things that people of Alcoholics Anonymous ask you to do. And you won't drink. And something else. The longer you stay in this fellowship, that conception will change. And every time it changes, it will get stronger. Well, I went out there that evening. And I'm not scared to say that was the happiest day of my life, because I knew when I came in that night that the drinking was over. The drinking was over if I saw fit to it be. That I would never have to take another drink as long as I live if I didn't want to. I didn't know that I wouldn't up until this day. Or don't know what'll happen down the road, but I knew it would never happen, that I'd never have to. What a relief off of my shoulders. Because I had come there with the idea that I didn't come there to get sober, just like a lot of people don't come to AA to get sober. We're forced here, and I was forced there, and I didn't come there to get sober. I came there because I didn't have anywhere else to go, and I didn't have any choice. I had to be there. But I knew, beyond a shadow of my doubt, that this was the answer. You know, rarely have we seen a person fail that has thoroughly followed our path. To take a path, you have to take steps, I think. And I think what they're talking about, our path, are the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bert said another thing that didn't make sense to me when he said it. He said, you don't have a drinking problem. You have a thinking problem. And your drinking is a direct result of your thinking. If you take all this negative junk in your life and you change it around to positive things, you'll be all right. You need to take this inventory. Resentments are our number one offender. And I had several. Especially that guy at the railroad fired me. I took his inventory. Resentments are our number one offender. Sobriety is our number one goal, I hope. And we can have both of them for a while, and sooner or later, one of them's going to leave. One of them's going to leave. And I was willing to do anything that they asked me to do. Or told me to do. They didn't really ask you back then too much. They told you. So I started working on these resentments. The antidote for resentments were prayer. And I wrote down these resentments about that guy at the railroad, and I read it, and I looked at me, and I read it, and hell, I'd have fired me. I don't blame that guy for firing me. I lost that resentment. Self-pity. You know, you can walk out here tonight, and if you got some self-pity, look around at, you know, something to be grateful for, and it'll go. It'll leave. Finding something to be grateful for. Quit lying. Hard doing my job. Slow down a little bit anyway. I just kidding. Start telling the truth. quit stealing, start paying your bills, doing the things that people are supposed to do. And our lives start changing. I got active in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous when I got out of there and found me a home group. I found a lot of home groups in this last 31 years. And started a life and married again. I met Bob's daughter and we fell in love and got married. And things really didn't work out, you know, the way maybe they should. But we had three beautiful children out of that marriage. Well, take it back. She had one before we married, and then she and I had a boy and a girl, and we lost this girl. And I don't talk about that much from the podium today, and 3 years ago. But anyway, we have I've got a girl and a boy. Got a girl that's 26 years old. I guess you might as well say she's cunning, baffling, and powerful. That's the best I can say. Since she's been a baby, and I still call her my baby, but since she's been a baby, she wants something, and she'll mention it to you, and she'll start out, and it may be 3 years later. If you ain't got it, she's going to stay on it till she gets it. And she's the baby, but she's a good child too, and she's never have been any problem with her. And of course, I don't mind giving her anything I've got, but she hadn't been any problem. I've got a son that 14 years old. He started having problems at school, and he wouldn't go to school. And of course, I was taking over. I said, "He'll go to school. I'll take him. I'll take him to school." And I said, "I know he'll go because I'll go pick him up." And I'd be up there and I'd pick him up, and he'd come out that door and jump in the car. Get home, next morning the teacher called and said, Philip didn't come to school. I said, "I took him to school." And he kept on, and he'd run off and he'd do this and that. And finally I pinned him down, and he said he had a drinking problem. And he went in to one of the hospitals there in Memphis and got some treatment, and he was gone about 2 or 3 months, and he came out, and of course, back then, I don't know if I did the right thing, or I guess I did, and that's the way life goes, but anyway, he came out, and he's 14 years old, and started going to AA meetings. And went to AA meetings through school and up until he's about 18 years old. He got out of school and he didn't want to do anything else with his life, but he quit going to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He moved up to Arkansas and got a job, married, and had a beautiful baby daughter. And she's 2.5 years old now. And I kept hoping maybe he's going to come on back to this fellowship. Heard Juanita say something earlier about a child, and here about 2.5-3 years ago, he got in through the grapevine. I heard that he had been drinking a little more than he should have, and something happened. And anyway, I talked to him on the phone, and he's fine, boy. He's really. My daughter is a lovable girl. I mean, you have to tell her you love her, and she'll tell you right back. But not him. He's liable to come jump on your lap or anything. Well, today, and he's going to tell you he loves you every time he gets on that phone. But anyway, I was talking to him. I said, "Son, I wish maybe you ought to come on back to some meetings." And he said, "Dad," he says, "alcohol is not a problem with me." And I said, "Okay." And I made up my mind that, you know, that's none of my business. It's none of my business if he chooses to drink. He's a grown man. That's none of my business. He's 27 years old today. He's grown. He don't ask me for anything. Don't ask me for much advice. I try not to give him too much. Sometimes, you know, we got to open my mouth. But anyway, I try not to give him too much advice because, oh, I tell him every now and then they better change oil in cars and stuff like that. Cut the hair, look a little better. And don't like the way they dress. But I never mentioned again about his drinking because it's none of my business, as I said. Well, you see people that come in this fellowship and they get sober and we start trying to sober up the world. And some of them was trying to sober up, don't even drink. Well, hell, I didn't figure it's any of my business. I do have a prayer that I say practically every day for him. And that prayer is if he ever wants help, if he has a problem, and if he ever wants to do something about his problem, as I want to do something about mine, is please God touch him as you touch me, and for that I'll be grateful. My AA group, and I can live with that, and my AA group is a Winchester group in Memphis. And we started that group about 10 years ago. We got a little tired, some of the older ones around town, and we got a little tired with the way things were running. And Franklin Williams, and we were all Wayne Reed, some of you know, and a bunch of the older timers. And of course, I was just really a young chap when old Kevin last night was talking about he was up here and the only young single person up here. I said to myself, I know how Kevin feels because I'm a young single person up here. But anyway, I was a younger person and all this sobriety, and we started the Winchester group. And old Wayne Reed, it brings back a lot of memories when I talk about our group. Wayne had been a past delegate, and he had a lot of problems staying sober. But he put together quite a few years. But one time, on Wayne's last drunk, he called Franklin to bring him some tapes. He said, Franklin, bring me some tapes over to listen to. He was bedridden, couldn't get up. And Franklin gathered up some tapes. If you'd ever been in his house, you couldn't walk through his house. It's so cluttered up with tapes and stuff. And anyway, he hauled him some, got him some tapes and took off over to see Wayne. And Franklin was a real dry person, and he brings the tapes in, and Wayne says, stick one in the thing for me, Franklin. And Franklin stuck one in there and started toward the door, and Wayne sat up in the bed and said, hell, that's me. And Franklin says, yeah. And if you listen to what that guy says and does what he says, you might get sober. And he did. He did. And my group, the Winchester group, is a great group. I today believe strongly also in sponsorship. I sponsor several people, and they've all been around here a long time. They've been around a lot of them. One man's in 50 years. He's my sponsor also, but he asked me not long ago, he said, will you be my sponsor? I said, man, well, how can I sponsor him? I can't take him through the steps again. I said, you taking your 12 steps? He said, it's none of your business. I said, this ain't starting off too good. I'm going to sponsor you just to be your friend. Can't tell Milton nothing. He knows everything. Tommy celebrated his 25th birthday last night. I can't tell him nothing. But as I said before, Alcoholics Anonymous was a love affair from the very beginning. Try to take the things that are negative in our life and do something about them. If you think you might have had a bad marriage, and you have got some beautiful children out of this marriage, you can look back and say, it wasn't too bad. Marriage wasn't too bad. If you've got a job and you don't like it, it's the worst thing in the world, and you get fired or you quit, and then you get you a real good job, making more money, and you like it a lot better, you can look back at this job and say, that old job wasn't too bad. You got away from me. And you can take alcoholism. Took everything from me that it could take from anybody. My self-respect, my dignity, everything. And then it turned around and gave it back to me through y'all, Program Alcoholics Anonymous. To me today, alcoholism ain't too bad. And if you don't think every day is not a good day, just try missing one. Thank y'all.